Welcome to Discovery 2, Module 7-ish. This is sort of going to be a clean-up lecture on various things we're going to talk about, and we're going to talk about all different sorts of things, and we're going to try and keep it as an interactive discussion as possible. So to summarise what I've been saying for the last 5 or 10 minutes, we'd like to hear feedback from any students who is having discovery problems with discovery. We'd like to know what sort of problems you're having, why you think you're having those problems, and possibly how you think we could help. Have you connected to the remote bundle yet, or are you sitting shivering in front of a newly installed copy of TerraTerm, terrified of opening the connection? Don't be. TerraTerm doesn't bite. It sends octets. So, let's find out what the problems are, how we can potentially solve them, and how many of you are actually going to do Discovery 2, with the precursor to say that networking underpins everything, including the Dean's potential TiVo box. I would warn you, however, Dean, TiVos are a very cool box, but they're basically inaccessible to us.
That's right, I was only wanting it for Jan. She loves recording multiple shows at once. That will enable her to do that.
Yeah, sort of makes you wonder whether, like, if you watch Home and Away, Sons and Daughters and Country Practice at the same time, does your brain, like, split into seven and go on dates and then break up with six people simultaneously or something?
I could make a comment to that, but no, they're not. I'm having trouble as it is.
Okay, let's move on. Okay. Before we continue on with bits and pieces of Module 7, and I ask this every week, but here we go. Does anybody have any questions?
Quick question.
Yes.
Now, this is in the working the small to medium business or ISP section of the curriculum?
Yeah.
Good. Okay.
Yes, this is Discovery 2, working for a small business or ISP. That is what it is called. Oh, and if anybody has been reading the announce list, which I posted to this morning, they've re-released the curriculums, Discovery 1 through 4, with embedded diagram descriptions. Woohoo!
Wow.
Oh, that's really good.
So will we get that if we go onto the QCAT website?
Not yet. I don't seem to have access to be able to download all the curriculums at this point, so I've got to speak to my partner in crime over at Curtin and get him to pull the new zips down. I will be updating. You will get the descriptions if you go through cisco.netacad.net and view your curriculum through there.
Sure.
So the actual notes, are they the same, Gary, or not?
Which notes?
The module notes, apart from the picture descriptions.
No, they've actually... Well, they reckon they're... fixed some problems.
Okay, because I just got finished tidying up all the notes from 1 through to 10. I've got to do it all over again.
Well, what you can actually do, and I'll get you the... there's a change summary on the tools page of Academy Connection, and I should be able to get you the change summary, so you should just be able to bash them around a bit, and you won't have to redo them.
Okay, yeah, no, I just got rid of all the bits and pieces that are unnecessary in them.
No, fair enough. So that's all very exciting. Diagram descriptions in all of the curriculums, Discovery 1 through 4. And I will endeavour to get those onto QCAT.org as quickly as possible, just as soon as I can get the zips across from... I have to find out why I can't download all the zips. Sorry?
From our fearless leader.
Yes, from our fearless leader. So we'll get those down and we'll put those up on the website. Sorry, I don't know whether there's any Arabic curriculum yet. I don't think so. They'll let us know, but it's not there yet. I think it was actually on the... Do you guys get, as students, do you guys get the Global Academy update emails?
Yes, okay. Some came through this morning.
Yeah, that's them.
Yeah,
I realised...
Them.
Yeah, do read them. I never used to, but there's actually some quite interesting stuff in there.
Cool.
Alrighty. We're going to have an impromptu quiz. Everybody into chat. Alrighty, we'll just wait for everybody to jump into chat then.
Okay.
Except for Leone, who doesn't need to be, I don't think, unless she wants to answer. Oh, maybe somebody else knows the answer to this one. Leone posed a question to me this morning. Why, when I go to my sister's place with my laptop, does my Outlook Express prompt me for a password? It doesn't do it at home. Anybody got any ideas? I said...
Is it a different service provider accessing the internet?
No, both Big Pond.
No, it's not that. The question has to be confirmed answer, does it do it from home?
Well, yes, does.
So you actually hooked that computer up at home?
I tried it yesterday, Elise, and it's not doing it from home.
All right, then I have... There is something you can do to chase it down. You can actually turn on logging of POP3 and IMAPS, which is under the Advanced tab of the Tools Internet Options, and then you can send us the log and we can tell you why it's prompting for a password if you try it at your sister's place. That would be a way of tracing that one down. But if anybody else has any ideas, I think it's just Outlook Express being difficult and most people usually give up on it and go use Firefox instead. Thunderbird.
Well, that's why I asked that question, because at the time I spoke to Leon about it, she hadn't tried it at the home location. So, and this is when you do an F5 to refresh the inbox to prompt it to check for new email, I assume.
Well, it's just mainly when I'm in Outlook Express, at least, without necessarily doing that.
All right. Well, is it a dialog box with two fields in it or three fields in it? This will be good.
Jaws.
In other words, is it username, password, and maybe domain or something? Or is it just username and password? Because if you've got the options set in Internet Options to dump you off the internet and try a dial-up connection, and that's one thing you can probably try and check for in your Outlook settings as well. It will try and dump you off the net and use a modem to reconnect. I've seen particularly with the back in Outlook Express version 5.5 in the early 6s, people would hook them up and that would plague us to death.
Yeah, that can happen.
Thanks, Elise.
Yeah, I call it the gatesing dialog box. You see that, you're in trouble.
Yeah, basically what happens is it thinks you're not connected to the internet and therefore it prompts you for a username and password for a dial-up connection. I find the easiest way to get rid of that is, unless of course you've got a specific reason to have one, and some people do, delete all the dial-up connections off your computer, because a lot of people go to broadband and then leave the dial-up connections in place
exactly. That
are no longer active or useful.
Yep, and then once you do that, you go into Outlook and say never... I think it's in Outlook or Internet. I haven't been in there for a while, but even when you are on a dial-up connection, go never make a connection in your email client. And there's often options in the tools options of the Outlook Express that you can turn off as well. And that way, it won't care what you connect with, whether you're connecting on a dial-up or connecting on a broadband. As long as the TCP/IP stack's there, it will go.
Also. Posting to the mailing list is an excellent way to get lots of students to look at the answer to your question. So try posting to the mailing list. That will also get you answers. There's a lot of things that could be causing it, and it is difficult to chase down. So there you go.
The question is, what happens when you type in the username and password? Does it go off and check and poll the email account okay after you type in the username and password there?
No, it doesn't. It just keeps pestering me for this log on username and password. I mean, I can.
Would it have to do that, Leone, because it's your sister's account that you're actually accessing the internet through? Even though it is still Big Point?
No, it's my own account, Elise. Dean, sorry.
No, it's not your own account, Geraldine, because you're actually connecting through your sister's router. Leone, even. It's actually because you're connecting through your sister's internet, her router has authenticated her, not you.
That's most probably why you're getting that dialogue message.
Well, it should just go transparently if it's another Big Pond instance, though, Dean.
And even if it's another ISP, unless you've got trouble with the SMTP outgoing email side of things, but you should be able to pop an account from anywhere. Should be transparent.
So yeah. If you're actually logging for your email, say for a different service provider, and you're logging and you're sort of at someone else's place using accessing the internet through their router, can you send and receive email through it or not?
You can receive, as in like you should be able to pop any account, but you will have to change the outgoing email. And yeah, you'll have to change the outgoing email settings in your email client to match their ISP.
So yeah, that's what I was just wondering. I had a bit of an idea, wasn't quite sure.
Yeah, I think what we need to ascertain, and this is next time, you can have a look next time you're over there, Leon. We need to know exactly what is in the dialog box that's coming up and what is the title bar, because it might not even be an Outlook Express dialog. It might be actually a Windows-generated one that's being triggered when you launch Outlook Express.
Well, what I could do, Kerry, is I could get my sister to have a look at the screen and tell me exactly what's coming up.
Well, either you could do that, or you could use your JAWS cursor and do it yourself, yeah.
And you don't even need to use the JAWS cursor. Actually, you do an Insert T on the dialog box to find out what the dialog box says in its own title bar, and then you tab through the dialog box and report to us whether there's two fields or three fields and what those fields actually are.
Oh, okay, I can certainly give that a try. Thanks, guys.
Well, you can always give it a try, and then if it doesn't work, you can then ask your sister. But give it a try yourself first, and then ask your sister.
What I'm thinking of, Kerry, in the light of what you said, and sorry to take up the lecture time and intrude, but what I was thinking, funny thing you should mention my sister's router, what I was wondering then, in the light of what you're saying, was would I have to log on using my sister's username and password in her router?
No. And I'll talk about that a little later in the lecture, but essentially, broadband accounts tend to use a protocol that we call PPP over Ethernet. It doesn't really matter what the protocol is called, but what usually happens is there are two ways of authenticating with the ISP. If you've only got one machine on the network, you usually feed the username and password for the ADSL account into that particular machine, and the reason you do this is for billing and time tracking purposes. If you've got more than one machine, you tend to key the username and password into the router, and the router takes care of authenticating the internet connection. Once the internet connection is open, you then don't have to authenticate from your computer because the router has already authenticated.
Oh, okay. So there's no need for me to authenticate.
Well, not for the internet access, but you may need to figure out what dialogue is actually popping up when you open your email as to whether... whether that
question.
Can... Yes.
Does a similar dialog box appear when you go and open a web browser session and look on websites?
As far as I know, no, it doesn't, Elise. I can access the internet from my sister's place, but I'm only having this problem with Outlook Express when I'm at my sister's.
Okay. It's worth asking, that's all, because I occasionally used to see it when it came up with Internet Explorer, who knows. But yeah, it's important to know exactly what it's calling that dialog, whether it's Outlook Express itself or, as Kerry says, Windows. And the only way we're going to find out is when you next see it.
And the moral of the story to this whole big discussion we've just had is it's very important, just to tie it back into the lecture, that you have as much information about your problem as possible so that when you take it to the technical people, they can resolve it as quickly as possible. So you want to know, what's in the dialog box, exactly what did it say, exactly what happened, what could I do, what couldn't I do. And one of the things we've noticed a lot on a lot of the help desks I've worked over years, one of the most useful, and I say that with a sarcastic spin, calls we used to get from users was when they'd ring up and go, "It doesn't work." Okay. And they go, "What do you mean, okay?" And I go, "Well, that's good, it doesn't work." "Oh, well, aren't you going to fix it?" I'm like, "Well, I don't know what doesn't work yet."
Yeah. "Oh, it doesn't work. I've had exactly... You sure you didn't get the same help desk people I got, Kerry?"
Well, they probably called both help desks and they probably told us both it didn't work.
Yeah, probably.
I can see your point, Kerry. It certainly does help to give as much information as you can, because if a person just rings a help desk and says it doesn't work, it doesn't give you any information, does it?
And also be concise. I'm very big on this with Yvonne, is I talk the Windows language. If I have to use the word checkbox, radio box, a radio button, sorry, dialogue box, I use it. And that is because you need to get it into the new user's head pretty quickly, the language of Windows. We want to know that we see a dialogue that says such and such with a checkbox that has an option or something, and we can tell them what option to click. Or we want to know how many fields the dialogue box has in your case so we can get a better idea.
Yeah, and to be fair, Leon has given us about 80% of the information we need. That's good. But, absolutely. But next time, you'll be able to sort of have more of an idea as to how exactly what information we need and exactly what sort of thing. Now, then the other thing, and this is a general comment to all students, and this is why I'm mentioning this, if you send me a message that says, I don't understand Lab 3.1.7, that doesn't help me. I know that you don't understand the lab, that's all good, and I'm a little bit sad for you. But I need to know, what is it about the lab that you don't understand? Do you not understand all of it? And if you don't understand all of it, which is the bit you most don't understand that you think will help you understand a bit more so that I can help you out with the understanding? It's not feasible from that message to actually go back and explain the lab to you in a language that you will understand just based on the fact that you don't understand it, because I don't understand what you don't understand so that you can understand it. Got that? Okay, good. But yeah, I mean, you just try and ask a question that will allow me to provide you the information that you need rather than just saying that you don't understand X, Y, Z.
In other words, elaborate as much as you can on what the problem is you're having.
Absolutely. The first part of a problem is defining the problem. We used to talk about the WISE method. What is the problem? Investigate the solution. Solve the problem and evaluate the response. That was one of those silly little...
This sounds very much like ITE.
It does indeed. It does indeed. Okay.
It's Creepy Chris has arrived.
Now, for the question that you wanted to answer earlier, there are 85 entities to do in ITE2, consisting of 48 labs and 37 worksheets.
Ah, thank you, Elise.
I just counted them up. Well, read the status bar in the directory, actually.
Which you can do by pressing Insert Page Down.
Yes, Insert Page Down.
Yeah, I think it is.
It is today, actually.
No, I know you actually read it, but I'm just... This is for the JAWS users amongst us. And I don't eat all those donuts at once. That need to know how to read status bars and things.
Cool.
Alrighty, we're having an impromptu quiz. Okay, here we go. The unique 32-bit number that identifies each computer on the internet is... A unique identifier, B, an IP address, C, a subnet mask, or D, a default gateway.
IP.
Sorry, what was B again, Karen?
UUID.
What?
UUID. It's a unique ID. I'm pretty sure that's what I said.
I thought the answer was IP address, actually.
Did I?
Well,
the
answer's
IP
address. Well, the answer's IP address, and I thought that related to B, but I could be wrong.
Yeah, yep, that's fine. That's all right, I just managed to bamboozle myself with A, B, C, and D. It's actually harder when you're thinking up the questions and remembering them.
IP address.
Okay, good. An IP address and B. Okay, excellent. Your computer is unable to communicate with any machines on the internet. However, Skype works fine. The problem is most likely A, your internet connection, B, DNS settings, C, the neighbour's kid that came over and fixed it yesterday, or D, the operating system in use.
B, DNS and the bloody kid.
Yes, I'll accept answers B and C for that one. And the way you can tell whether things are going wrong there is Skype actually doesn't rely on DNS to function.
That's right, whereas MSN and everything else does.
That's exactly right. And although it's infuriatingly tedious, you can actually use the connection troubleshooter in MSN to diagnose some of those sorts of problems as well. Actually, I think the troubleshooter's in Windows Live Messenger, actually, now that I think of it. Okie dokie. Hang on, let me see if I've worked this out properly. Okay. On a subnet with a /27 prefix, how many IP addresses are available to hosts?
Three.
Yes, Dean, I've got your answer. Anyone else want to come up with an answer? I'm not saying whether he's right or wrong yet. Does anybody know how to work it out?
That's the Chapter 10 stuff I'm going to reread again for the third time. And if I wasn't doing IT, I probably would have.
Okay, fair enough. Okay, it so happens that Dean is correct. Well done, Dean. He spends too many hours in front of that remote bundle, I think.
Bashing away at the pegboard.
Okay, how many bits in an IP address? Anybody other than Dean, tell me.
32.
That's right, and I said that the prefix had a prefix of 27. How many bits does that leave me left to have 32 minus 27?
5.
What is 2 to the
Yes.
Yes, that's
what's
right.
2 to the power of 5. 32 minus 2 for the two IP addresses you can't use, and that's how Dean got 30.
Yeah, unless your broadcast address and your IP address.
Network address.
Yeah, that one.
Yeah, cool.
Alrighty. Okay.
Well, that's sweet. Now it's easy.
Yeah, look, I'm not asking these questions to be deliberately tedious here. I'm just trying to...
No, because we can learn stuff out of it. I like it. Keep going.
Okay, what's another question we can come up with? A machine has been assigned a 169.254.87.4 address. What is the most likely problem with the network? A, the machine is running Windows. B, the internet connection is down. C, the machine cannot reach the DHCP server. Or D, the network in the card in the machine is faulty.
C, F.
What's F? Dean fixed it.
D.
Alrighty. The machine cannot reach the DHCP server. Can anybody tell me what sort of address that is called? A, ice cream. B, apnic. C, a pipa. Or D, IPv6. Alrighty. How many bits in an IPv6 address? A, 32. B, 64. C, 907. Or D, 128.
D, 128.
That is correct. Anyone seen India this morning?
Do we have a neighbour on Kelly or not?
Don't think so.
Maybe their holiday started early.
Okie dokie. What else can we ask about? Okay, I'm just trying to think of all the stuff we've covered. Okay, here's an interesting thing. You have just connected all of your new PCs onto a brand spanking new Belkin wireless router and have enabled the top-of-the-line encryption to stop your neighbours from stealing your internet access. Your brother's 2-year-old PDA cannot connect. The problem is most likely what? A, your brother. B, the new wireless router. C, a mismatch in encryption settings. Or D, a cordless phone in the area.
C.
Okay, and can anybody tell me what in this pretend situation, apart from Mr. Legg, what might be happening here?
Okay, we're talking about the non-pedantic answer, which is C and D here. I did say answer A for the brother, because the brother is often the problem.
Yes.
Okay.
Could be a misspelt password, like login password.
No, I think what you'll find is one of the things you've got to keep in mind is depending on the age of the equipment that you're using, not everything supports WPA and WPA2. In fact, a lot of wireless devices only support WEP64. And WEP 128. Also, unless you have applied the hotfix from Microsoft and you're not running Service Pack 3 of Windows XP, Windows does not support WPA2 out of the box with the Xero configuration wizard. If anybody wants to know what the Xero configuration wizard is, it's the thing that goes, one or more wireless networks is available. Click this impossible balloon to connect.
And also the channels too, Kerry, you've mentioned that when you had an issue with a laptop of Jenna's, when you put it on, I think it was Japan or something, for a different channel.
Yes, that can certainly be a problem. There are certain PDAs that only have a channel range of 1 to 11 because they're US. The wireless chip's been set to the US, which has a channel range of 1 to 11, and you might happen to have your wireless network on channel 13.
And channels 1 and 11 don't overlap?
No, channels 1, 5 and 11 do not overlap. Actually, 1, 6 and 11, sorry. There we go, I'm better now. Okay, so that's certainly a problem you could be having. Alrighty.
And sometimes if you've got 7 or 8 wireless networks around you and they're all, for some strange reason, using the same channel.
Yeah, that can certainly be a problem. Okay. I had another question that's disappeared out of my head. Oh, yes, here we go. The primary difference between RIP version 1 and RIP version 2 is A, the number. B, RIP version 1 does not transmit subnet information. C, the person that invented them. Or D, not really any difference at all. They're just there in the notes to confuse you. Okay, yes, RIP version 2 sends subnet information along with their routing updates, and RIP version 1 does not. Alrighty. Okay, I think we've had enough quizzy bits, because I have trouble thinking up all these quiz questions. Has anybody noticed, and I don't know whether this is going to change in the new versions of the Discovery, but it looks as though the quizzes are still inaccessible. Have you been able to access the quiz or the chapter summaries, Dean? I've tried.
The quiz, what, the normal module quizzes?
No, the quiz at the end of the chapter.
No, I really haven't bothered, to be honest with you.
All right. Does anybody know whether they are accessible in Discovery 1? Okay, I'll take that as we don't know. Okay, we'll have to look into that.
I'll give it a lash this afternoon or tomorrow, and I'll let you know.
Yeah, no. Look, I'll probably have another look myself. But it was just, I know everybody loves Geraldine's quizzes, and we've got them there because they were pulled out of the curriculum last year. But I don't actually recall the quizzes being accessible.
Well, the quiz went. Text and Word documents that I've got anyway.
For Discovery?
Yeah.
Yeah, alright, I'll have to check that up. I'll check that up because I think they might be hiding along with the SVN of the exam diagram descriptions.
I can't remember where I downloaded them from, but I'm sure it was off QCAT.
Oh, righty. Okay. Alright. Oh, another thing to remind people of, there is a hotfix that came out today from Microsoft. I believe it's hotfix 957,844. And it's the one that allows anybody with unauthenticated access whatsoever to bust into anything in your system using SMB/SIFS, in other words, the file sharing protocol. So if you don't have the patch for that one, you probably do want it if you're running Windows.
Is it available for non-Windows Service Pack 3 people?
It should be, although why you're not running Service Pack 3 by now, I would be very interested to know.
Would I ask error?
Well, this is just it. I did actually have it on at one point and it got cut it off, so maybe if everyone's, because a few people I know who have tried it says it's good, so I might let it come down.
Well, I tend to download all of the service packs and store them on my server so that I can just apply them to machines very quickly without having to sort of drag them down all the time. Saves them coming down through automatic updates, and I do that with the big automatic updates like Office Service Pack 3 and stuff. You store them away and you can just drop them back onto machines. I haven't had any problems with Service Pack 3 that I know of, although I have noticed that Service Pack 3... does tend to use a little bit more memory than, say, Service Pack 2 machines do. I tend to find Service Pack 3 machines do thrash a little bit more if you're in low memory situation.
We installed Service Pack 3 on my daughter's Toshiba laptop last night, and we had to turn off AVG antivirus for it to continue.
I've never seen that. No, I'm running AVG.
Yeah, but it was the 7.5. We haven't updated the antivirus on the laptop yet.
Ah, that will certainly finish you off. AVG 8 is well worth having over 7.5 once you turn off the scanner.
So I've got to do it the next couple of days because she's moving to Melbourne next week.
Oh, just get Elise to do it.
Yeah, she's going to live with her boyfriend.
Ah, wait, what suburb?
No. I think it's Fitzroy. Or Essendon, one of the two.
Oh yeah, it's a fair way away, but yeah, if they get into trouble and there's anything we can do to help, let us know. Sure they can take a trip out of the milk gravely and...
There's a young Indian lad. He's an accountant in Melbourne somewhere.
Yep.
So now we know how to get tax done now if we ever have to do it.
Fair enough.
No, actually what you can do with tax is you can actually ring up the tax office and ask them all the questions.
No, I haven't had to put a tax thing in for a while, so... Yeah.
Alrighty. Okay, that's really good. Most of the people who seem to have problems haven't turned up today. Excellent. Okay, we're going to talk about Chapter 7. And are we finished?
Is Ibram or Philip on at all?
Nah. No, they've actually... From what I can tell, they sort of get on about 7 p.m. Perth time, and they sort of jump on their computer then, so I sort of get emails at about 7 or 8 Perth time, and then I get a few more at 2 in the morning Perth time, not that I'm up to actually receive them. And then that's about it.
Because what GMT are they?
I'm not sure.
I know they're a fair few hours behind where we are. I think they must be like GMT plus 5 or something like that.
Oh, righty. I think they're around GMT actually. I don't think they're too far from GMT. Interestingly enough, you could always go into the Windows date and time properties and find out by looking at the different time zones, but you don't have to. But
well, I can bring it up on my Nokia N95.
I can bring it up on my N72. There are also time zone scripts for JAWS for Windows that were written by a friend of mine called Andrew Hart, and you press Insert F12 three times quickly, and it actually brings up a time zone list, and you can actually find out what the offsets are of all the different countries.
What you need to install the script for that, I guess.
That would be quite handy.
Yes. There we go. I'm turning in homemade chocolate fudge here. Okie dokie. Alright, so, Chapter 7 basically talks about the internet and the services that they provide, or don't provide if you've got the wrong ISP. Now, what are the two primary protocols that are transport protocols that are part of the TCP/IP protocol suite? What are the names of them? And I've given you the name of one of them indirectly.
TCP and OIDS.
Anyone else got an idea?
Yeah, TCP and UDP. UDP is used a lot, it's VoIP and so on.
Ah, and do you know why UDP is used a lot for VoIP? Because that's in this module as well.
Because it's not concerned about the transmission of the data or anything.
There's nothing to check to see if the packets actually get there, is there?
No. The difference between TCP and UDP is TCP tends to be connection-oriented. In other words, you open a connection and you transfer data and then you close the connection. It is considered end-to-end reliable. In other words, the data should get from one end to the other.
With the three-way handshake and the rest of it.
We'll get to the three-way handshake in a minute. The idea that TCP is end-to-end reliable means that the data will get from one end to the other. But unfortunately with TCP, if there's actually a hiccup in the communications channel, what'll actually happen is you'll be halfway through speaking and you won't actually hear anything until you've actually finished receiving the data. Okay, and UDP is connectionless. In other words, you send off the datagram and you don't know whether it gets there or not unless you've got high-level error checking in the upper layer protocols. It is also worthwhile noting that TCP has a lot more overhead than UDP. UDP only has about 8 bytes of overhead, whereas TCP has about 20 bytes because you've got to have all the sequence numbers and the error correction stuff going on. Okay, can we have some examples of protocols that use TCP?
Yes. HTTP, POP3, what's another one?
FTP.
IMAP, FTP.
Yep, POP3, yep, IMAP is another one, definitely. Yep, that's TCP.
SSH.
Yes, of course, SSH, which is something we say to Chris a lot. And SMTP.
Yes.
I think it was Bianca. Bianca once said SSH or I'll bash you. Okay, moving right along. Yeah, we have to have a recorded laughter track, that's right. There is actually parts of DNS that use TCP, although mostly DNS uses UDP. So apart from DNS, what's some other examples of protocols that use UDP?
VoIP?
But you have to be more specific. VoIP is actually made up of a couple of protocols. One is known as SIP, yeah, which is the Session Initiation Protocol. And the other one, an RTP, which is a Real-Time Transfer Protocol.
Mm-hmm.
So the VoIP, but Skype is also a form of VoIP.
Which also uses UDP, if I'm not mistaken.
And also has TCP in it for its file transfer.
And it also uses TCP for server presence detection. It actually opens a TCP connection to the server to show that you're online. It's not purely UDP.
Mm-hmm.
Alrighty. Okay, and what are the things that differentiate the different protocols when you are opening and closing sockets? What are those things called that tell you which protocol you're actually talking on?
Ports.
Ports?
Yeah, or port numbers. And can anybody tell me what port HTTP works on?
Hey.
Good afternoon, Gemma.
You can't say good afternoon to her yet. Now you can. Good afternoon, Gemma, possibly.
Yeah, good afternoon, Gemma. How are you today?
She may not
be... okay.
Ah. Still waking up, are you, sweetie?
Yeah.
Did the immigrant work?
Well, it stopped it getting any worse, so I basically went back to sleep.
Ah, fair enough. You're busy cutifying Chris here. Alright, have you got yourself a coffee yet, dear, or do you want to wander off and get one while we're lecturing away?
No, I'm happy just sitting here.
Okay. So, we ascertained that HTTP ran on port 80. And we... can anybody give me another couple of examples of some protocols and the ports that they run on?
SSH 22.
FTP is port 20 and 21.
POP3 110, I think, for memory.
Yeah. And IMAP is 143.
Cool. SMTP 25.
Now, I think somebody in the chat mentioned SSH, and Telnet is on...
is 23.
Telnet 23,
isn't
it?
Yeah, I think so.
Yep. Yeah, Telnet is 23.
DNS 53.
Yeah, DNS is 53. And you know where you can look all these up if you can't remember and you're not Chris because you're powered by 7 donuts?
I actually posted it to the discussion list recently.
Yeah, I got it in a bookmark somewhere.
There's also a file in C, Windows, System 32, drivers, etc., I think called services, and they're all listed in there.
Like there's also one in Linux under etc. something.
Yeah, etc. services.
Yeah. So that's another idea, MS pinch from Linux.
Well, MS had to pinch a fair bit from the Unix-based TCP stacks, otherwise it wouldn't be compatible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because the host stuff is also looks very etc. under host etc. slash host etc.
Yes, and in fact one of the really bargain basement ways of ad blocking is to insert the IP addresses, the names of ad blocking sites in your C, Windows, System 32, drivers, etc. hosts file, so ad.doubleclick.net, and point them at 127.0.0.1 so that it doesn't actually ever go to ad.doubleclick.net to pick up the ads.
Cool.
We also had a problem where, due to the way the router was configured here, inside the network you weren't able to go to www.qcat.org, because if you did, it would actually resolve to the external address and it would try and do a hairpin NAT, in other words, go out and come back in through the router, which on this particular router model wouldn't work, and you'd end up sort of trying to authenticate with the router. So the initial solution we came up with before we actually set up DNS was actually to put www.qcat.org.192.168.100.151 into all of the hosts files on the workstation. Alrighty. And Dean was talking about this three-way handshake thing that TCP has, and it has a three-way handshake because it needs to, first of all, it needs to synchronize the sequence numbers, and the sequence numbers are how TCP decides which packets and which bits and bytes and stuff need to be transferred and which ones don't. So first of all, the initiating machine sends a synchronization packet. The remote machine then sends an acknowledgement packet, and then the initial machine sends a packet with the SYN and the ACK bit set to say that the connection is now open and ready to send and receive data. Now, I seem to remember that being covered really well in Discovery 1, or was it CCNA 1?
CCNA 1.
Yeah, yeah. So if you're looking at the old CCNA 3.1 curriculum, yeah, I think it was covered really well in Chapter 10 or 11. It was actually quite a nice explanation of one of the nicer ones.
I think it was Chapter 10.
Now, the other thing I want to point out about the notes, and this is going to sound really obvious, and probably everybody on channel will have realised this, but this is all the students who aren't here at the moment. A couple of months ago, I was asked by somebody to define a term. Funnily enough, when you're arrowing down through the labs, it sometimes says, sometimes you are connected through a link NAT router, which performs link network address translation. Now, believe it or not, hitting enter on those links will actually pull up a glossary definition for the term that the link points to.
Even if you cut and pasted it into Word, the link still works with control enter.
Yeah, so there you go. You can even launch the links from Word. Glossary is like celery, except it's not green. A glossary is a dictionary of terms.
And always Google.
Yeah, or www.whatis.com is good.
Yep. Or even define colon word name if you're a bit worried in Google. Yes, that's Gene said.
Absolutely. Well, the TCPIP.com website's really good for a lot of the terms. Or Webopedia, I think's the other one.
Yeah, and there's also that TCPIP book we all got you for free.
Yeah, and that's really good. They haven't got all the way through it, but there's a lot of info and it's good.
Well, all right, Dean, next week there'll be a test on advanced window scaling just for you. No, just
yeah, very funny. I might go to that Indian thing. That'd be good.
Okay. Guidance for the week.
I want to find out where the Delhi Lama is because they'd know where the sausage rolls were.
That's right.
Okay.
Next to the donuts.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, moving right along. Okay, what's next? Okay, so you've got all these ports and stuff, and we've talked about the three-way handshake, and we've talked about the various services that the internet provides. Can anybody tell me what is the most common use for DNS?
For looking up domain names.
Resolving domain names for IP addresses.
Yeah, resolving, yeah, that's right, yeah, that one.
Yes, it generally resolves www.thathotgirl.com to 127.0.0.1. actually, I think there was a there was actually somebody who actually did put a Somebody actually did put a www.my-wares.com, which pointed at 127.0.0.1. Okay. We've just had, just Chris has been, I said there was possibly a microphone in the storeroom, and that we were just looking for one. But then, what? They're all gone. Yeah, well, there is this, yeah, we'll sort something out. Microphone's pretty easy to get hold of. But there is a snowball, he could have used that. Okay, it maps IP addresses, names to IP addresses, and IP addresses to names. Can anybody tell me what is the name of the zone that maps names back to IP addresses? There's a tricky one. You might not know this one.
Reverse DNS.
Yeah, but can you tell me what the DNS, what the actual name for it in DNS is?
Is that NS lookup?
No, the actual name of the reverse name, and what I was looking for was in-addr.arpa, in-addr.arpa, which I'll just key into the chat.
Okay.
In-addr.arpa.
So, in fact, if what you've got, so say for example you, okay, so in the DNS you've got resource records, and you've got various bits of data. Okay, so what you can have, for example, is a DNS record can look like this.
EliseRocks.com in 123.45.88.2.
Okay, so they've got EliseRocks.com in A, in other words, IN is the internet zone. A is an A record, 123.45.88.2. And that might be the site for EliseRocking as far as,
EliseRocking.
I actually saw a funny quote the other day that says, I like blind people, they rock. Okay. But what you actually have, and I'll do this with a 192 address, so for example, in my DNS, we've got a record like this.
GOTSS1 in a 192.168.24.1.
Okay, so you've got GOTS1 in a 192.168.24.1. Okay, that is an A record. But to actually map it back the other way, you actually have a record that looks like this.
GOTSS1.GOTSS.net PTR1.24.192.ADDR.ARPA.
Phew. I'll just make sure I got that right.
Mm-hmm. Well, something said January 24 at me, and it's 1.24.
Now, that'll be Jaws' date interpretation getting in the way there.
No, it's just sappy speech from this thing, not Jaws.
Ah, fair enough. Are you using eSpeak for your sappy now, or are you using SAM?
I am using... I don't know what the heck it is, actually. I've got eSpeak running, but it's... I'm just talking about in Ventrilo here.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about.
It's a high-pitched voice. I think it is a form of eSpeak. It's not SAM.
Fair enough. Okay. Now...
it's eSpeak.
We don't actually go through a lot of this.
What happened to the 168?
Yeah, I thought I'd gotten it wrong.
I can see 192 in ADDRS.ARPS.
Yeah, I've missed out the 168. Hang on a minute, I'll just redo that again.
GOTSS1.GOTSS.net PTR1.24.168.192.ADDRS.
Okay, that should be better. So, as you can see by practical demonstration, it is quite possible to make typos in your DNS zone files. And it happens all the time, and then you've got to go back and fix them. But it's very important to verify your zones before you take them live and make sure you've put the correct information into your DNS things, or your website won't resolve. If your DNS breaks, that tends to stop your website dead in its tracks. Funnily enough, you just sort of don't see people going, sorry, our DNS is unavailable, our DNS server is broken, so why don't you log on to http://203.1.91.6?
Yeah, that would be good.
Yeah, I mean, people don't like remembering IP addresses, generally speaking. Okay, now, the DNS system is hierarchical. It's one of those words that we all love to use in networking, so we sound really, really, really intelligent. Hierarchical. It's like functionality. It has hierarchical functionality. That makes it really cool. Okay.
Yeah.
So, what you end up with is, can anybody tell me what the name of the root zone is? And this is slightly a trick question.
Root.
No. The answer is dot.
Oh, okay.
You don't often see domain names that end in a dot, generally speaking, on the internet. However, in zone files and things, you do actually have to have domains ending in a dot, and I'll explain why in a moment. So there are two parts to a... has anybody heard the term fully qualified domain name, or FQDN?
I have, but I don't know what that is.
It is the combination of a host name and a domain name. So, spanky.ellismedia.com.au is a fully qualified domain name, which we hope doesn't exist.
And it doesn't, but how would that relate to, say, lonsdalemedia.com.au? Would that be hostname.lonsdalemedia.com.au or something similar?
Well, okay, and this brings up an interesting point. Okay, when you register a domain, say lonsdalemedia.com.au, like for example, you might want to register that, obviously, you are asked for two NS records. Can anybody tell me what NS stands for?
Name, server, yes, and yes, I know that then.
And you have to provide two NS records, and that tells the internet at large where your domain is hosted.
Correct.
These are known as glue records, because they glue the DNS together.
Ah.
Okay, but what you have, you're generally pointing at, so you have lonsdalemedia.com.au, NS, and you have lonsdalemedia.com.au, NS, You then have lonsdalemedia.com.au in A, and you have an A record, so that when people open their web browser and they get lazy and they don't type www, it will actually come up with the right page. But there is a problem with that.
All right, keep talking.
Yeah. The problem with that is the way email is delivered, and I'll talk about... Actually, I'll come back to that. So there is a problem with having an A record pointing at your website that's just got the domain name
sure.
in it. And I'll get back to that in about 5 minutes. Okay, email, the killer app of the internet. Woo-hoo-hoo, email. Okay, so email uses a DNS as well. So, for example, if you're emailing cavi-instructors@gots.net, which you should with any problems you might be having with Discovery, you definitely want to be emailing cavi-instructors@gots.net and explaining those problems to us so that we can help you. You can have my home phone number when it becomes a 1-900 number and is $10 a minute. Okay.
Who
so,
are you paying?
Yeah, yeah, not me. The other people who ring me. That's right. Okay. So,
is that a reverse DNS?
That's exactly right. So, what we do then is we have email, and when email is delivered, the email client is supposed to look up what we call MX records. Anybody know what MX is?
Mail Exchange.
Yes, or Mail Exchange records, or Mail Exchanger records. And you have multiple MX records in a domain. So, for example, I have GOTS1 in MX20, MX2.zonedit.com, and I have GOTS in MX10, GOTS1.GOTS.net. That means I have two mail exchanges, and I have priorities 20 and priority 10. The lowest priority is tried first, then if the lowest priority is down, the next priority is tried. What happens if you have one MX for your domain and that machine is down?
And it ain't going to get through.
That's right, and it is held for a certain amount of time, and if the mail server doesn't come back up, it is bounced.
Question.
Yeah.
So we have one MX record for, say, my machine, and can we have another MX record for a secondary machine that might be somewhere else and a little bit more reliable than your own? Is that what you're trying to say?
Yeah, in fact, that's what I'd be definitely saying, because if you've only got one MX for your domain and that machine is down, your mail will not be queued and held and stuff. So you probably want backup MX for your domain, especially if you're being one of these home users like me that runs email over a DSL link. If that DSL link goes down, none of your emails going to get delivered, and it's not going to be stored anywhere.
So the question then, I could then actually, rather than moving my
full domain name away from this hosting company that was giving me a lot of grief. Now perhaps I'll find another hosting company. He's set the second MX record to either my new wholesale hosting company. So if Challenger does go down because of my ADSL or a power outage, I can go on top that email off the server that's with that in a data center, and we'll have some email for the night.
Well, MX records are only used for incoming SMTP, not for POP.
Okay, so once they've landed up on this other server, I'll still have to get them off there somehow.
That's exactly right. And if you were going to... Okay, when we're talking about mail accounts, we're talking about mail for whole domains rather than mail for individual users. Now, I know you do have a whole domain.
Yeah, I understand what
you're saying. Yeah, so what happens is your lowest numbered MX is supposed to be the final destination of the email, generally speaking. So if you have multiple MX records and multiple machines that are happy to accept and receive that mail, you'll then have to go through and check all of the possible machines to pop mail off any of them that it might be on.
Right, so that's what I was about to say. Then you've got to figure out how to get the mail off it. Well, there's a couple of ways I can start thinking about already.
Or what you can do is you can pay for a service called ETRN, which is a way of store and forward SMTP if you can find somebody who offers it cheaply. And what can actually happen is it'll queue up on a particular mail server, and then when your ADSL link comes back up, you can send a command through to trigger the mail queue, which will dump the mail down onto your local machine with your local mail server if you have a local mail server.
Kerry, does DIN's DNS have mail hosting? There was some mention of it when I went through the settings.
Yes, but it costs money.
And my new wholesale hosting provider is providing pretty much the service that you've just mentioned, Kerry, that will allow that to happen, and he's sort of selling it in the respect of change your MX records to me, and I'll filter your spam, and if your mail server happens to be down, like in my case, we'll hold your mail until it comes up.
Okay, question. Can anybody tell me what's wrong with your mail hosting company filtering your spam, potentially?
Like with everything, you've got to go and log into their system to check to see what's in the quarantine area.
They can filter legit messages.
Yeah, and they can also filter legit messages. In other words, they can profit. If you get a false positive, they can throw away a message you should have received.
That's what I can do.
Could that message then actually put on the blacklist without you knowing?
Well, it depends. We're not exactly talking about blacklists at the moment, but I've noticed actually that Comcast, good on them as usual, have managed to blacklist Amnet's mail service. I don't know why.
Yeah, we've seen this sort of stuff happen with different hosting companies I've used too. They've got it onto the blacklist that Optus is going to be banned, so therefore anyone SMTPing out of Optus gets blocked, which is crazy.
Yeah, it is a problem.
Optus wireless block port. It's 25 too, which is a bit silly, but, you know, that's their choice.
Ah, there's probably a reason for that.
Yeah, it's because they're trying to eliminate spam and so forth.
Yep, anyone who's on a dynamic IP address, whether it's wireless or ADSL, will probably find their access to port 25 is blocked.
Now, there are reasons for that.
Wanted to use that, you wanted to use your DORA, but that uses port 25. I can't find anywhere to change it.
No. The reason they blocked 25 is a lot of dial-up users had bots on their machines that were talking SMTP and sending out buckets and buckets and buckets of spam. 80% of spam comes from dial-up machines or dynamic IP address machines.
Yep, dynamic IP addresses. And I have seen some come from ADSLs, but they'd be ADSL with dynamics. If you have a look in my... what file is it that tells me the log of what gets blocked, the mail log file on my system, and you'll see a lot of dynamics and ADSLs and, statics and all sorts of stuff in there that are coming from probably, as you say, little robots on people's machines that they don't even know are there.
And yet, on the Optus website, they say that you can ring them and have it unblocked, and they won't do it anyway. Just a waste of a phone call.
That depends. See, the thing you've also got to keep in mind, Dean, is that if you are on the Optus network and you are with Optus, you should be relaying your mail through Optus's servers.
Yeah, it's just that Dad wants to use your DORA for his mail client.
They won't stop it. You can just point it to
It just won't work.
mail.optus.com.
at mail.optusnet.net, or mail.optusnet.com, .au, and it should SMTP out through Optus.
No, yeah, it won't. It drive it.
Hang on a second. So Outlook Express, does it work?
Yeah, Outlook Distress and Thunderbird and all the other ones work fine.
Yeah,
it's only the drawer.
Because it's using secure authentication.
So if I uncheck that box, it should work.
No. You've actually got to go and tell. You've got to tell your Dora to securely to use one of those SSL SMTP or whatever. And it is in the advanced options. If you actually see what's happening is you're trying to do unauthenticated SMTP with your Dora, which will fail. Whereas Optus actually needs you to authenticate with their server with the username and password so that you are authorized to send out. You'll find, for example, if you sign up for SMTP with say gmail.com or yahoo.com, you have to turn on authentication. Otherwise they won't let you send messages through their server.
I was wondering when there were servers using that facility, because I've never come across one.
Because there's a checkbox that says allow authentication. Is that what you're referring to?
There are a lot of options in Eudora. I'd really have to go hunting for them, but the options are there, and it can talk SASL or whatever the authentications that need to be talked, and you can actually change the connection ports. It is in there, but you do have to be running the latest Eudora, which is Eudora 7 or whatever. Be warned, however,
the
Eudora
last
is no
one is
longer maintained.
Oh, you know, I know that. I'd still use it myself. It's just like it more than the Outlook Express.
Yeah, I think they have taken it on the Mozilla Foundation. They have actually put Eudora as part of the Mozilla Foundation. So there will be further development on Eudora. But be aware that because it's no longer maintained, if a bug is discovered in Eudora or some virus, it will tear through your system. There won't be anything you can do about it, so just be aware of that.
Oh, okay. So even with the firewalls, because it's allowing the email to come through, yeah, any weird ones I just delete anyway.
Yeah, but if somebody does manage to find a flaw in Eudora, like a buffer overflow or something that they can exploit, and it has been done with most mail clients in the past, if they find one, you're in trouble, so keep your eyes open for one, because it won't matter. Some of the flaws just require a certainly crafted message in a certain way to be received in a certain way, and that's it.
Mm-hmm, you know, I'll get close check on everything. We do anyway, so since we're dead, I've got to keep on.
Okay, so back to what I was saying earlier. So, you look at your MX records, and they have priorities, and the lowest priority is tried first, and then the one up from that, and then the one up from that, and then the one up from that.
Mm-hmm.
Does anybody know what happens if you have no MX records for your domain?
I guess if you have no MX records, you would find if you send email to it, it will bounce.
Not quite.
Okay, I'm open for suggestions.
Anybody know what happens if you've got no MX records?
The world blows up and it's end of modern civilization as we know it.
No, it actually is delivered to an A record that is the name of your domain.
Delivered to an A record that is the name of your domain. Clarify. This is good.
In other words, if you have an A record of your domain that says lonsdalemedia.com.au in A 129.4.8.6 that points at your hosting company because you want people to be able to type lonsdalemedia.com.au, if you have no MX records, then the mail will try to be delivered to the A record of that domain instead. And in fact, some badly behaved mail service software will actually try delivering to the A record in preference to the MX records because it's broken. So that's
the question. So now that you've got your email delivered to your A record, whereabouts does it land up on the server that the domain is pointed to then? In an email box like it should, or somewhere in the never-nevers?
Well, it depends on whether the A record for your domain is actually pointing at an SMTP server or not. If it's not, the connection will be refused. Most email software, however, has been upgraded to fix that problem with the different A records and MX records and stuff. But it is aware, you've got to be aware that you should have MX records in your domain, and you should have those MX records pointing at the right spot. And in fact, I've seen a lot of MX records, and MX records must point at fully qualified domain names. In other words, 20 in MX, sneezing.lonsdalemedia.com.au. It should not point at an IP address, and it should not point at a canonical name record. A canonical name record is an alias record. And you have alias records. Can anybody tell me why you have alias records in your zone? What's the good thing about alias records?
There are several email addresses under the one email address.
No. Alias, as far as the domain name system is concerned, you have alias records,
multiple
for example.
Domains?
No, you have multiple names for the same machine.
Yeah.
So a machine can be called web, FTP, mail, pop, www. And the reason you do that is so that if you change the machine that actually hosts the mail or whatever, you only have to change where the CNAME points. Whereas if you actually have the www pointing directly at the A record, you've actually got to change the A record.
Mm-hmm.
So there you go. That's a bit on DNS. Okay, but DNS is hierarchical, and the root domain is called .. Then there are what we call top-level domains, or TLDs, as they're known. Can anybody give me some examples of TLDs?
.co, .au, .nz,
.org,
whatever.
Yes, .org, .net.
Yep, .net.
.go.
Quick question.
Yep.
Okay, top level domain to me is the last bit, which is au.au.co.uk or whatever. Does that also encompass for all those ones that don't end in a country code? For example, the ones that have been mentioned on chat, like .org.net.com. Would you call that part of the top level as well?
Yes, it is.
So basically, a top level domain can either end in the .net.au.com, etc., or can end in a country. If it ends in a country, then do you still refer to the .com.au, the .com?
Fine.
You're back now, and this happened on Wednesday, as Jenna points out.
Yes, it certainly did, and we don't know why.
They're not on one of those ISPs that chop you off after 24 hours to reset their billing system or anything strange, are they?
No, AMCOM didn't previously do that. And if it was AMCOM, if it was the ISP that did that, Gemma should have been knocked off as well, which I don't think she was.
No, that's true.
No, Gemma was still here. Oh, I thought Gemma was at home.
Yeah, but yes, we're on AMCOM as well.
Yeah, but what Hotkey do is they knock you off every 24 hours for a second, and it's 24 hours from your last log-on time. So Vicky and I are on Hotkey, but we could be having a different 24-hour set of 24 hours, if you know what I'm trying to say.
Okie dokie. All right, so we're all back. Yeah, no, I have seen those ones that drop you off every 24 hours, and it's an absolute pain in the backside, especially if you're doing a big download and you get knocked off at the time and the site doesn't support your favourite download manager.
Yeah, I know, yeah.
And there's absolutely no reason to kick people off every 24 hours to reset their billing system, fix your billing system, and keep an eye on how long people have actually been logged
in. Exactly. Pretty much, I've told them off about it 1,000 times before.
But I'm going to see, given the fact that it happened to us at the same time on Wednesday, I'm going to have a look and talk to some people around here and see if something has been turned on or off or something strange has happened around the same time or whether something's cutting into action or something that could be disrupting things. Interestingly enough, however, though, the modems and stuff are on and ups.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, what was I on about? Just to remember now.
Yeah, the disruption when that happens. I think you were just telling us about where the mail ends up, if it's sent to an A record. Then you started to talk about
Yeah,
I was talking about the different domains layout.
Top server. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's right. It was top level and stuff. That's right. And I was asking the question. I was speculating over the top level. That's right. So my question, I have a quick question there.
Yeah, your question was, you know, do you treat things like .uk, .cz, .de as top level domains? Yes, it's the last component of the domain name is the TLD, and in fact there's been a lot of resistance, but a lot of sites actually wanted a .xxx TLD created.
Yes, I know. Now, that led me to my second question, which I think I was putting at the time you disappeared. So let's say take a domain that's a .com.au, like lonsdalemedia.com.au. In that respect, the AU would be the top level. Would you also, in that respect, treat the .com bit as the top level as well? I just simply refer to it as the second level. I don't refer to it as anything.
You'd refer to it as the second level because
it's demoted in that instance. Yeah.
Okay. There is a big difference between .com and .com.au. .com is the top level .com domain, and .com.au is actually the .com domain under the .au domain, which hence the hierarchical. So what happens is when you fire up... Now, the things that resolve names are, funnily enough, called name resolvers. All this complicated stuff we try and get you guys to learn. And yes, Chris is back on MSN again. Okay. And what you actually do is you... when your name server is loaded, it loads up a cached list of what we call the root servers. And the root name servers are the ones that know about all the TLDs, top-level domains. So, your classic resolver knows about all of the root servers. And you can actually look those up yourself and find out what the root servers are. And you do it like this. I have to type it into chat because it'll probably be easier.
Sorry, Gary, what was the question again?
Set query type was dot.
And the last thing was dot. In other words, just a full stop. So you go, this is how you look up the root domain name service. So you go nslookup and you'd enter and it says current server is yada yada yada, greater. In fact, DeckTalks used to go right angle bracket, but yours just goes greater. And you go set query type equals ns because you want to look up name server records, and then you put in full stop and it'll spit out all of the root name servers.
Cool.
And that works under Linux and Windows and just about any operating system with a TCP IP stack. You could. Okay. Now, one of the things that is interesting about this is that, so you know all of the root name servers, and then, okay, so we want to look up lonsdalemedia.com.au because Elise has just made a new website and is going to pay us a lot of virtual money to check out the accessibility of her site. It'd be like virtual minties and stuff. You know, you're not going to actually see any of it.
Come to lonsdalemedia.com.au.
And we'll actually get Chris Legg to do it because he's such a charitable bloke. He'll do lots and lots and lots of work for free. And what'll happen is into his web browser...
Anything for donuts.
He will put in www.lonsdalemedia.com.au. Now, the resolver knows about the root name servers, so it says, okay, what name servers can tell me about .au? And the root name servers go, oh, this one and this one and this one and this one and this one. So your resolver then picks one of those servers and says, okay, who can tell me about .com.au? And it says, oh, this one and this one and this one and this one and this one. And then it says, all right, and it jumps to the next name server that came back in the next lot and says, who can tell me about lonsdalemedia.com.au? And it says, oh, this one and this one, this one, this one and this one. And then it goes, okay, now who can tell me about www? So you actually walk your way up through from the bottom, from the root of the domain tree, and for each time you walk up the domain tree, you actually have to query and find out which name servers know about which domains. And the reason they've done it this way is it means it's decentralized the domain name system. Elise might be responsible for the name servers that run lonsdalemedia.com.au, so she is authoritative for those zones, but she's certainly not responsible for .com.au, which is run by somebody else. So, that means that theoretically she could register a subdomain of lonsdalemedia.com.au called kittensinabagwithabrick.lonsdalemedia.com.au. And sure, she could have www.kittensinabagwithabrick.lonsdalemedia.com.au, and she... and throw it into pool.ntp.org. Very good. Okay. That's just an example, but you can register whatever subdomains of your domain that you want or that you feel you need.
Yes.
And that's kind of handy. That decentralizes the management of the DNS, because the people who are responsible for a particular domain hierarchy, part of the domain hierarchy, are then responsible for the things that occur under that domain hierarchy. Which leads to an interesting situation. For example, before .com.au was deregulated, there were only about 3 or 4 people who could actually decide whether something would go into .com.au or not. And we had a company called bricksandbits.com.au. They wanted bricksandbits.com.au, and they wanted to register that, and the name of their company was Bricks and Bits, and they did have that registered in the register, and then the domain people said, oh no, that's too general, you can't have that as a domain name. But they're like, but that's the name of our company. Alrighty. The other thing you've got is you've got a primary name server, which is responsible for the data that you have for your domain, and then you have a number of read-only copies called secondaries. And they actually are backup copies of your domain, and that is so if the primary goes down, the secondaries will be able to serve the information. Alright. Has anybody here not used NS Lookup before? Actually, Eddie and Leon probably haven't.
No, we haven't.
Oh, that's okay. You can tamper with that later, but it is a handy-dandy utility that will look things up. Yes.
Was that set query type equals DOT or just simply full stop?
No. That was set query type equals NS, and then you put in a full stop on a line by itself.
Kerry, just a quickie.
Mm-hmm.
Was that MS Lookup, as in Microsoft?
No, it was NS, Name Server, November Sierra Lookup.
Thanks, Kerry.
And there are web-based versions of these tools, although a lot of them require captures because of anti-spam technology. And if you're not a member of blinkyblinkywebthing.com, what's it called? WebVism! You don't have the capture killer thing, so you have to go and do it by other means. And there used to be a whole lot of good ones on www.geektools.com. Alrighty. So that's essentially how the DNS works, in a nutshell. And good network administrators should know how to set up their own DNS. Shouldn't they, Elise? No, just stirring you up there.
Yeah, they should, but they don't.
Just winding you up. I'm sure you'll get to it one day.
Yes.
It is actually bind for Windows, in Windows XP, in Windows 2000 and stuff. If you feel that chronic about it, you can actually run bind under those operating systems. We usually prefer Linux boxes to run bind under. They seem to be a lot better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or there are lots of dynamic DNS providers that you can use to register things. Now, the other thing I was going to point out to people who haven't played with it, www.opendns.org. Very useful service. They have the ability to... They have very fast DNS servers, and you can plug them into your resolvers, and there's all sorts of instructions on how to do that. And, in fact, what we can do is, if we want Chris Legg to do some work, we can actually tell OpenDNS to block Facebook and YouTube.
Oh-ho!
Of course, we don't block Facebook and YouTube. We have proxy logs, and we will track him down to the ends of the earth. And then if he thinks he'll unset his proxies, I'll put a firewall in rule to block any port 80 connection from the workstations. So, yeah. But, yeah, you can do those sorts of things, and OpenDNS will block what they call time wasters, such as Facebook, YouTube, Boggle.com, Clango, and stuff like that, and Cisco.net, because we don't use Cisco.net. Of course, Cisco.netacad.net is definitely not a time waster, and neither is Cisco.com. And neither is going to PayPal.com and sending lots of money to Kerry@gots.net. That certainly won't be blocked.
Kerry, is there a good software package around that logs the amount of data going in and out of a internet connection?
That's not one of your kids, is it, in the background I can hear?
Yeah, that's my younger son.
Yeah, you can let go of that button any time you want, dude.
That's right, I'll just hold it down for you. Well, he taught himself how to play through some program on the internet.
Just tell him he's got national coverage every time you press the button to talk.
But he's got into this
international
music, which is absolute rubbish. But anyway, in between that, he's got all the chords and more music. He can actually read music as well, which is really good.
Interestingly, I don't know whether we can make a request, but it depends what he knows how to play. Look out, or I'll pull my harmonica out of my backpack and start playing it on Ventrilo. Okay. Somebody asked a question. Is there a good software package? No. The reason for that is... you need to be able to extract that information from the device that's actually sending and receiving the traffic.
And the router's only got basic sort of logging. It only gives you sort of within 30-second brackets of time. It doesn't give you overall what IP address is downloading, whatever.
Ah, but you see, that's why you are supposed to insert a Linux box between your router and the internet, and then you configure up something like IPTraf on the Linux box to track all that sort of stuff.
Okay. A project for the holidays.
But you couldn't do that if the Linux box was, I guess, parallel to your workstation, i.e. the way I've got it set up. You would actually need to connect to the Linux box, is what you're saying.
Well, what would actually happen is what we've done, and I haven't actually got IPTraf in there because I'm usually the one doing all the downloading and Gemma doesn't download much at all, except for when I occasionally let her watch a few YouTube videos now and again, which, for example, you might want to check out The Retarded Policeman, which if you get offended by any of that, then I'm sorry, don't go and check it out. So we disclaim all warranties, but there's a whole lot of YouTube videos on The Retarded Policeman.
Very offensive.
It sounds good.
Yes, it certainly is offensive, and there's even a little song that goes along with it. That said, moving right along, so what you have to do is you actually have to have two network cards in the Linux box. You turn your router into dumb mode, which then disables all of the voice over IP stuff and that you paid lots of money for on it. And then you run all the traffic through your Linux box, and then you can track it down and monitor it and slice it and dice it and find out who's doing what.
I look at the way it is at the moment, because the point
like
looks really good.
Mr. Taylor, I think, is done with Oberon. I think that's what Oberon does.
Yes, but he doesn't have that sort of complex logging and stuff in at this point because Nuts hasn't figured out how to do it, so he hasn't done it.
Yeah, pretty much. I think he'd be shocked if it was there anyway. With Robert living there, but anyway, that's another story.
We won't talk about that. So that's essentially how you could break it down. I mean, that has been asked by a lot of people, you know, how do I see what my kids are doing? How do I see rah, rah, rah? Funnily enough, it's usually the kids that work out how to crack NetNanny and stuff before the parents do.
Yeah, I know who it was. It was my eldest son smashing these music downloads. Idiot. Just because he can download it over 500 kilobytes a second, he thought it was never ending.
Yeah. The other thing, I've got this mail out from a friend who will remain nameless that says, go and sign this petition to stop internet censorship. Doesn't matter whether you get 300,000 email addresses or 3 million email addresses, it won't really make much difference because the government wants to put the censorship through anyway if that's what they're going to do. We all tried this when volume charging came into effect back in 1993. We said that volume charging would be a bad idea and please don't do it, and it happened anyway.
If they want to do it, they'll do a dodgy deal with a minority party and the rest is history.
Well, what actually happens, and this is the interesting thing, the ISPs have actually refused to do the censorship because they rightly maintain that maintaining the censorship filters would be their responsibility and would be technically infeasible to maintain on a long-term basis.
Yeah, look, that's fair enough. And probably contravene a whole stack of privacy rules too. You'd have to make sure you're very careful the way you worded your legislation. Yeah, it's too hard.
Well, certainly difficult for ISPs and stuff in that particular instance. A lot of the record companies, for example, would like to see ISPs block all non-legitimate and music downloads that don't have DRM in them. They'd like the ISPs to block all of that illegal content. For example, the interesting thing with that is that it's not going to stop people from copying CDs and handing them around at school.
Well, the old sneak in it.
And the other thing is that if you if you're clever enough, you'll send all your traffic through encrypted transports and stuff anyway, and you'll do it with peer-to-peer things that run on your machine, and they won't go through centralized music sites, which will then hurt the revenue of the centralized music sites. And it's, yeah, look, I mean, the record companies just haven't learnt that DRM annoys people. It's probably a good idea in theory, but if you can only play it on three devices or only play it three times or whatever, I think it was Microsoft's media player had that thing where you could beam a song to another person and then they could play it for 12 hours or something and then the song would disappear. Well, I think it must have been about 3 hours after the scheme came out, people found a way of stopping that 12-hour expiration timer.
Yeah, that'd be right.
Yeah, it's like my son's got all this music from, what's that Macintosh program for music?
iTunes?
Yeah, iTunes. And his ex-wife played, there's like 10 or 15 gigabyte of his music that she paid for, and they're all password protected. Can't use any of them.
I assume he doesn't know the password.
That is correct.
That's why it's his ex-wife.
That is, yeah, no. I could say something.
I'm joking. It's all right. Let that slide through to the keeper. That was a throwaway line. We're moving on.
No, there's mostly a way around it somehow, but anyway, it's a shame. Nevertheless.
Unfortunately, though, a lot of those scams, if you don't have the password, there really isn't a way around them unless you had the password originally. You can actually deprotect the iTunes files with SoundTaxi or similar programs, www.soundtaxi.info. However, you must make sure that you have the legal rights to do that, and you must also have passwords initially to be able to decrypt it.
So you have to have the original password, I gather.
Yeah, and if you were going to do research into not having the original password, we certainly couldn't discuss that here on lecture.
Okay, we'll talk about it later with you.
I know nothing about it, to be honest. You'd have to research it up yourself.
As you do. I don't think I'll bother. I've got enough music anyway.
Well, certainly with that guitar in the background.
It's really good. He's hopeless at mathematics and stuff, and yet he can do that. Just amazes me. He plays a lot of music, but he just listens to it, plays it back, works out what the chords and things are. Yeah, it's quite good.
Yep, and well done for him. We, of course, all do that. You're probably aware. Geraldine and I and Gemma, we're musicians. Not sure who else. Peter does a bit of singing and stuff, if you don't run away fast enough. And there are a few other people who are musical as well, and we do a lot of it by ear as well. But, yeah, no, that's really cool. We're just about running out of time. It's almost 1 o'clock. I hope everybody's enjoyed the lecture. It sort of wandered around a bit, but I hope we all got something out of it today.
There's a lot of things I wasn't aware of. There's all these records and things. I know it does mention some of it in the notes, but you covered a lot better. It was really good.